Owning a boat comes with a number of perks, like being able to fling your favorite fishing rod around. And here's another perk. GEICO's boat insurance covers your boat and your belongings. And with specialist support from agents that are as passionate about boating as you are, there's so much value that you'll want to high-five someone. But not while you're holding your fishing rod. That's a prized possession. So hold on tight with both hands and keep it covered through boat insurance. Get more with GEICO.
Aaron already had it pulled up because that's his as well.
Yep.
I don't believe it.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dyson.
I heard moaning. I was worried.
I was faking it, you stupid jerk.
Don't ever call me stupid. And I'm not jealous.
Then leave.
Okay. It's a nice place. Don't touch his dick.
Hello, everybody. Oh, look at that. Look who Gunnar. Look at Gunnar Henderson making
nice
a
nice card.
That's right. Hello, everybody. This is episode 156 of Wreckatopia. The big recommend today is A Fish Called Wanda. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by Jeremy Scott.
Hello.
And Aaron Dicer.
Heidely-ho, Cleeserinos.
That's right. And we would like to once again welcome chat, who have come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. Welcome, chat. Thank you very much for coming out. We'll start off with some small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty-bitty living expense.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
And I will kick us off with a movie I saw over the weekend. There's a movie night that I go to every month, and one of the people chose basically a Dogma double feature, basically. It's the Danish sort of movement that started in the 90s, where there was a bunch of rules that they set down for themselves to make movies and everything. And the first, the second of these movies that we watched was The Celebration, or aka Festen. The movie is about a patriarch having his 60th birthday party, and he's invited a whole bunch of friends and family to come out and celebrate this. However, his kids have something to say at dinner that sort of changes the tenor of this whole birthday celebration. Some people choose not to believe it, but the people who do believe it have had their world completely shattered and changed and everything like that. I don't really want to tell you much about what that announcement is. I will tell you that it is triggering. It will be triggering for some people. This movie, though, is oddly darkly comic and very funny in a lot of places. The announcement is certainly not funny or anything. It certainly, will make you take pause and say, how are they going to even go through the rest of this movie? That's how bad it is. But the movie is very funny and very well done, and I do recommend it. Now, there was another movie out of this group that I could also heartily recommend, but I would also say with a lot of caveats, and that's Breaking the Waves. That was the other one, the Lars von Trier. And that movie, it was devastating. It's one of those movies that I can recommend to film fans, but if you don't want to be super depressed by the end of the movie, then you can't watch that movie. It's one of those like one and done kind of deals almost. So anyway, Festen, really good, really funny, really well worth it.
So my habit has been, if one of you guys are small recommending something I haven't seen and I have a chance to, I'll fire it up and watch it. So I did this with Festen last night, since it's on Criterion. Oh my goodness, this movie. Uh-huh. This movie blew me away. Now, I knew nothing about the Dogma thing until after I watch this. So I'm watching this in there. There are these weird moments where like audio will cut between cuts, or like it has a very lo-fi feeling to it. And I'm like, oh, it must have been, you know, Thomas Vinterberg's, you know, first movie, and he was trying to figure stuff out. No, the Dogma idea is like you cut out all of the movie making trickery. So there's no artificial lighting. There's no, you know, artificial sound. Every sound you hear in the movie has to come from the video you're watching it on. So there's no music. Everything has to be diegetic. So it's just like the idea is it's like this purest form of just like shooting stuff with a camera and making a movie. And beyond that kind of interesting element, you're right. And I'm so glad, you know, not to spoil it as well, but that dinner scene just knocked me on the floor. And then I was just in for the rest of the time. This is, as you mentioned, could be triggering. So do some research if you have some triggers that you might want to be aware of. But man, I'm right on this recommend with you. So good. So
awesome. I'm glad that you got a chance to see it.
Yeah. That kind of exchange makes me feel bad for every time I've recommended something like 2015's Vacation. To know that Aaron has gone and watched as many of my small recommends as possible. And I make some pretty shady ones.
Hey, I saw Vacation when it came out, so that wasn't your fault.
Jeremy, what would you like to recommend today?
Oh, well, here's a shady recommend, but it's not for a movie. It's for a video game. I'm here to recommend Civilization VII now. Mm. Before I start, let me tell you how much the internet hates this game. it is 3 stars on Steam, which is where a lot of PC gamers buy their games. There are 4 times as many people playing Civ 6 as there are the new Civ 7. But Civ 6 is like a 9-year-old game. And just a little bit on the internet, Google users rated a 41%. Steam gives it a 6 out of 10. IGN, 7 out of 10. It's buggy. There are patches already. There will be more. And there are a lot of gameplay changes from the last version. So, all of that out of the way, I am having so much fun playing this game. I did not like Civ 6 because it introduced a new concept called districts that I never quite got my head around or worked into my personal strategy when I played these games. And everybody has their own way of playing these games. Let me tell you what I love about Civ 7. And then I'll try and explain briefly why I think it's getting such negative reaction. It's gorgeous. It is far and away the most beautiful looking Civ game. Barring the interaction screen when you talk to another world leader, it's pretty simplistic, and that's one of the big gripes people have is that screen's UI is lame. But when you're looking at the actual map, you can zoom in on your cities and buildings. It's freaking beautiful. This version of Civ breaks the game up into 3 ages, and a unique twist this time is in between each age you can pick a different leader. So when you start the game, you pick a leader like I don't know, Thomas Jefferson or Gandhi. Gandhi's not even in this game, I don't think. Harriet Tubman is one of them, and she's ruthless. She actually is. You can change leaders in between ages, and then you're forced to pick a new civilization because it goes through the ages of exploration, information. I don't know what the ages are. Anyway, it gives you an opportunity partway through the game to change your attributes and change what things you earn by doing certain tasks, and it really allows me to explore more civilizations and more of what the game has to offer by making those changes. One other change they made that I love is that you can take your armaments, your swordsmen, your riflemen, your horsemen, and you can group them all up under a battlefield leader and then move them around the board as a group, which is not only convenient practically, but it also frees up clutter on the screen and makes it a cleaner looking game. Here's what I think is happening. I don't play a lot of video games. I play some golf games. I play Civ every 9 years when they come out with a new one. But apparently it's become very common over the last 10 years for video games to launch in what users call beta stage. And people are angry about paying full price for a game that isn't quite finished yet. And game makers are now using early adopters as test subjects, essentially, to figure out what to fix in the game. So I think a lot of Civ 7 players have 10, 12 years of that baggage built up that I don't. And so to them, they see an unfinished game and they don't want to be a pawn. Mm. And it's a $70 game, the base level. and they feel like there's going to be add-ons that cost money down the road, like a fourth age. So I understand all of that. I'm just telling you, I don't have that baggage and I'm really enjoying the game. So
Yeah. That's all that matters in the end. I mean, that you're enjoying it and that, yeah, I mean, I do think that there's like sort of a collective that always attacks anything that new that comes out. And I think you're probably dead on as to the reasons for it. It's, you know, it's like, why can't the game be just completely 100% finished and 100%? I mean, no game, even as much as they test it out and everything like that, is going to be 100% perfect when they come out with it. And
sure.
So, I mean, sure. I think there are some that take advantage of that and they Absolutely. Make a real terrible game and throw it out there. And then they'll do some sort of improvement that they should have done beforehand. But this is a game here. It sounds like it's completely functional and fun and it might have a bug here or there. And, you know, it's fine.
Yeah. I'm enjoying it.
Aaron.
Yeah, my small recommend, I've been catching up on some older Criterion stuff and watched my first Jacques Tati movie, Mon Oncle, forgive my French, is my uncle, is what it stands for. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know, Jacques Tati just made a few movies, and they were pretty much all this Monsieur Hulot character, who is kind of a bumbling, you know, Mr. Bean meets Charlie Chaplin, you know, kind of that kind of thing. In fact, in my review, I said you can draw a line from Charlie Chaplin to Hundreds of Beavers, and you're going to intersect Tati, because that is what this character is. Mm-hmm. And I had an absolute blast with this movie. It is the only one of these movies I've seen. And I thought there's a scene, I'll just one example, there are many during the movie, but there's a scene in a like modern kitchen. This movie has a lot to do with like satirizing like modern living in the 50s or whatever. And so there's this really, you know, interesting kitchen, and the pitcher that you put water in is like the base of it's like a bouncing ball. And so he's like astonished by this pitcher, and he's like dropping it on the ground and it bounces back up to him. It's an amazing. And so then he gets out a glass to pour water in, and he drops the glass and it breaks on the floor. And it's just the look on his, it's just like, you know, perfect setup, timing, payoff kind of stuff that is throughout this. So if you enjoy that kind of comedic setup, payoff, almost, I think he actually, Jacques Tati is a mime. I think he was a mime in France before doing this kind of stuff. So it almost plays like a silent film at times. But yeah, it's really fun, and I'd recommend this one or any of the others, even though I haven't seen them, because this character is really fun.
I feel like I've seen one Jacques Tati movie, and that was when the Belcourt was running a few of them out here, and I don't remember which one it is. I actually have the box set of Jacques Tati here at the house, and this movie is part of it, but I haven't seen I haven't seen those. But it was funny, I don't know who it was made a point that he's kind of like one of the first cinematic universe kind of guys or whatever. He's I mean, movies had serial type of stuff going on since the beginning of time, so it's not anything Marvel and all that, of course, is old hat. But like, he did things where I think it was like basically they were just different movies, but they sort of were interwoven into the same universe and everything like that. And you know, anyway, it was I need to see this one. I need to see all of them. Need to see need to actually crack open some of these box sets of
I think Playtime is probably his most famous, and that immediately rocketed to the top of my list, so I'll watch that as well. But for now, this is the only one I've seen.
Yep. All right, we're going on to the big recommend, which is A Fish Called Wanda, and it was my selection, so I will get it kicked off here.
I'm fine, it's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Fish Called Wanda is a 1988 film directed by Charles Crichton and written by John Cleese. We begin in London, where the movie gives us a brief montage of the main characters during the opening credits. John Cleese is Barrister Archibald Leach, which some of you will recognize as a nod to Cary Grant. Jamie Lee Curtis is Wanda, a woman who has just cased a jewelry store using a hidden camera in her purse. Kevin Kline is Otto, a man who apparently falls to sleep reading Friedrich Nietzsche, but wakes up gunning down an alarm clock. An alarm cock? Alarm clock. Finally, we have Michael Palin playing Ken, a huge animal lover with a fish called Wanda. Early on, Wanda introduces Otto to Ken, and we can see immediately that Otto is a real asshole who can't let Ken stutter go without comment. Otto is apparently being introduced to the Diamond Heist crew for his proficiency in weapons. He also strongly implies he's been in the CIA, and I guess he was. I don't know. We don't know anything about Otto, really. Most of the stuff is lies. The apparent ringleader of the group, George, played by John Georgeson, arrives, and it looks like he and Wanda are an item. Otto is introduced as Wanda's brother just before he shows off his amazing knife throwing skills right into a picture of a seal, which makes Ken gasp. Archie is married to Wendy, played by Maria Aitken, and it is readily apparent they are in a loveless and boring marriage. When Archie comes home from winning a case, Wendy tells him this is the only time she's had to herself all day. He also has a spoiled daughter named Portia, played by John Cleese's real daughter, Cynthia Cleese. The Diamond Heist is so big that it could net over 13 million pounds, or 20 million American. The plan is not meet up at Heathrow Airport until after 72 hours, when the police will stop checking the airports. As Otto leaves, he insults Ken's love of animals, and at the door, he gives a kiss to Wanda, and it's apparent that he's not her brother, or else this is a different movie entirely. Wanda apologizes for Otto, explaining that their father used to beat him up, to which Ken says to himself, good. During the heist, Otto indeed shows how very good he is at using weapons to take out the cameras, and even places an apple on top of one of the diamond store's managers and almost shoots it before it's time for everyone to escape. As they make their getaway, they nearly run into an old lady walking three dogs that will soon become one of the movie's darkly comic side plots. They go to a hideaway where the diamonds are thrown into a safe. Everyone splits up, but within seconds, we see George return to the hideaway when no one is there, the first of many deceptions and or double crosses this movie has in store. Next, we see Otto and Wanda kissing for real this time, and it looks like they're planning to steal the diamonds for themselves. The first part of this plan involves Otto calling the police and telling them everything about George. The cops descend on George quickly, but George is able to put a key that goes to something we don't know about yet in Ken's fish food and toss it out into an alley or something before he's arrested. When Otto tries to crack the safe at the hideaway, Wanda looks poised to knock Otto out and take the diamonds herself. But of course, the diamonds are not there, and Otto's unconsciousness will have to be put on hold. Otto ironically asks, "What do you have to do in this life to make people trust you?" The connection between the two stories occurs when George gets Archie for a lawyer. George is telling a massive lie about his alibi that his parents apparently can confirm, or I think it's later, it's his girlfriend that Jamie Lee Curtis can confirm. Another lawyer in the room whispers to George that Ken found the fish food. Wanda goes to visit George in jail, where George tries to get he and Wanda's story straight. He tells them the jewels are safe and that if he goes to jail, he'll use their return to get his sentence cut down, and even says he can get his sentence cut even more by telling them his accomplices, wink, wink. George suspects Otto turned him in, but he's not entirely sure. After the visit, Wanda goes to meet Archie, pretending not to know he's involved with the case and pretending to be a big fan of his, even asking for an autograph, and continues an even bigger lie by saying she's studying the British legal system as an American student. Archie does appear quite taken with the attention he's getting from a beautiful woman that he's not getting at home. He even leaves his briefcase on top of the car as he drives off. Wanda now believes she can seduce Archie and get information that George relays to him. Ken visits George in jail and shows him he has the key. He also tells him a secret place he's going to hide it that we, the audience, are not allowed to hear. George asks Ken to watch Otto. When Ken gets back to his place, Wanda's there with Otto, and she spies on Ken putting something in the treasure chest in the fish tank. Wanda pretends to have just taken a shower and pretends to be startled when she emerges from the bedroom. Ken doesn't know why either of them are here, and even questions why Otto was in the bathroom where Wanda supposedly just had a shower. Otto is somehow able to deflect all that by pretending to be really into Ken. Wanda pretends to get a call from someone who knows that the diamonds are in a garage in some other place. Ken then tells Wanda that George moved the diamond somewhere, and when Wanda tries to kiss the information out of him, Ken can only say that he's got a key and he doesn't know where the diamonds are. Wanda, knowing where Ken put the key, takes it to a locksmith who can tell her that it goes to a safety deposit box, which could literally be anywhere. In the next scene, the old lady with the dogs is able to identify George in a lineup. Wanda goes to visit Archie at his office. Still pretending to be studying British law, she casually brings up her friend George and all the scenarios he could be faced with in court. But when Archie finds out that she's the same Wanda that is George's alibi, he realizes the breach of ethics and asks her to leave. Wanda then tries to seduce Archie, but a visitor comes in and breaks it up. A brief intercutting between Otto and Wanda with Archie and his wife shows that Otto and Wanda are having great American sex, while Archie and his wife are having a boring, sexless British marriage in separate beds. But Archie does accidentally call out Wanda's name while Archie and Wendy aren't having sex. At the pretrial stuff, George tells Ken to kill the old lady that identified him. Otto sees the exchange and confronts Ken about it outside, loudly. Otto bets that Ken won't kill the old lady. Meanwhile, Wanda, dressed up in a costume like it's Halloween or something, once again tells Archie that she wants him and doesn't care about the case whatsoever. After Archie says he'd love to, but he can't, Wanda pretends to cry and walks away, knowing for a fact that Archie will be receptive to an impromptu visit while his wife and daughter are out of the house to watch a show. Otto wants to know how far she'll go. He seems to be okay with everything as long as she doesn't touch Archibald's leech. Otto helps Wanda break into Archie's house and puts on the full court press. Archie finds a loophole in talking to her by saying as long as they don't talk about the case, they're fine. Wanda, believing that sex will eventually win the day, brings up the case while they're making out, but Archie's boner doesn't allow him to break the law just yet. Before things can go further, Otto's jealousy enters the picture and Wanda has to redirect Archie's focus so that he doesn't see him. Wanda gets Archie to go fetch some champagne, and Otto argues with Wanda about how far she can go. But just as Otto is about to leave, Archie's wife and daughter show up because they had a flat tire and decided to go home, meaning both Wanda and Otto have to hide. And then Archie shows up with the champagne and finds that Wanda and Wendy have essentially traded places. Wendy notices a car outside that is blocking the driveway, and that's when Otto comes in, revealing himself as Archie's guest and also a CIA agent. Archie doesn't know who Otto is, but has to pretend he does, or else his potential affair gets found out. Otto tells an outrageous story about a KGB agent in a safe house nearby and has the terrible misfortune of running into a woman whose father worked in the Secret Service and knows that CIA agents wouldn't be telling people about stuff like this. There is also the matter of a locket Wanda has dropped on the floor, the one containing the key to the safety deposit box. Portia finds it while hiding Wanda tries to retrieve it, and eventually Wendy thinks this is a gift that Archie got for her, and she loves it. Luckily, the W for Wanda can also sub for Wendy when you're telling true lies. Wanda has to take the moment to leave without her locket. In Ken's first attempt to kill the old lady, he gets a vicious dog to go after her, but the dog ends up snatching up one of the old lady's dogs instead, which mortifies the animal-loving Ken. In an act of stopped heart shadowing, the old lady grabs her chest and takes some pills. In the next scene, Otto visits Ken and Wanda at Ken's place, and while Wanda is in the bathroom, Otto notices a letter that Archie sent to Wanda talking about a rendezvous at a friend's flat where they can meet and he can give her back her locket. With this information, Otto asks Wanda if Archie has tried to get in touch with her, and she lies that he didn't. Meanwhile, Archie is making up a lie that the locket he gave Wendy was actually something an old woman brought into the shop to get engraved, saved and that they sold the locket to him by mistake. Archie tries to give her a replacement necklace, but Wendy loves Wanda's locket so much that she refuses. Wanda then meets up with Archie at the friend's flat where the missing locket is still a problem, and he can't even give her the more expensive replacement that he got Wendy because Wanda claims it was a locket her mother gave her on her deathbed. However, he promises to get the locket, which is good enough for her, and then they start to get intimate. Archie is worried about whether her brother will show up again, and when the unknowing couple starts talking about how stupid Otto is, that's when he shows up out of nowhere to tell him, "Don't call me stupid." Otto asks Archie to apologize, which Archie is not willing to do, but in the next scene, something has turned the situation upside down as Otto has Suge-knighted Archie out the window like Vanilla Ice. We get an extremely entertaining apology that includes the finer legal points of slander. Ken's next attempt at the old lady has him in a Rastafarian wig running her over in a car, but he ends up flattening another dog. Next, we have a scene where Wanda calls Otto out on his bullshit and his faux intellectualism, telling him that Archie is the key to getting what they want and that he needs to apologize for what he did. He goes over to the Leech house where he witnesses a robbery in progress, but it's Archie trying to come up with a cover for stealing back the locket, so of course Otto shows up to save the day, not knowing it's him. He beats Archie up, then when he finds out it's him, apologizes, but can't even do that without beating him up more. He decides to run just as Wendy comes home and discovers her husband beat up on the floor. He wakes up in time to find the locket and very impressively puts all of it in his mouth while his hands are tied behind his back. Wendy tries to show concern, but Archie, realizing it's late, runs out of the house, claiming he needs to attend a conference even though he's been beaten and the house was burgled. Back at the friend's flat, Wanda shows up to meet Archie, and he kisses the locket back into her mouth. Wanda now officially wants to have sex with Archie, and it's official when she asks him if he speaks Italian, and he does. But even more so when he eschews that for Russian. Archie gets naked, and that's when a large family with four children walks through the door, having rented the flat, and quite surprised to see a naked man greeting them with his faulty tower hanging out. After that, Archie comes to his senses and breaks it off with Wanda. When he comes home, Otto is waiting for him to apologize, and during the apology, the cat is out of the bag that Archie was the burglar and he was having an affair with Wanda, and Wendy hears it. Ken's next attempt at killing the old lady is by shooting some scaffolding that is holding a freezer or something. The freezer, of course, lands and kills the third and final dog. When the old lady discovers her last dog has died, she dies too, and Ken comes down to join the concerned people who have gathered around, only to laugh his ass off. He goes to tell George about it in jail, where he shouts, "Un-be-fucking-leavable!" A new plan for the robbers to get their happy ending is hatched. When Otto comes to visit Ken, lets it slip that he might know where the diamonds are, which is at Heathrow Airport. Otto ties Ken up to get him to talk, first sticking French fries or chips up Ken's nose when he can't answer some questions about literature. When he asks about the diamonds, Otto starts swallowing Ken's fish to get him to talk. He gets all the way to the last one, the one named Wanda, putting her in his mouth, and is able to coax the airport hotel name out of him by running through the names until Ken reacts. Otto asks where the key is, to which Ken responds the treasure chest in the fish tank, but it's not there, and Otto swallows the Wanda fish. Still, Otto realizes that Ken thought the key was in there, so he figures that the human Wanda took it. Otto calls Wanda, and they arrange to get the diamonds, but first Wanda has to testify at trial. Wanda goes completely off the rails and throws George's alibi under the bus. Her surprise testimony breaks Archie to the point that he gives away the fact that he knows Wanda better than he should. George ends up trying to kill Wanda right there in the courtroom. Wendy, who just happened to be present, tells him she's getting a divorce. George calls Archie out about knowing Wanda too well, but Archie insists the slip-ups were due to him coaching her. It's now deal time, and Archie tries to get the location of the diamonds out of him to reduce his sentence, but George wants to give up his co-conspirators Otto and Wanda for a reduced sentence instead. He tells Archie to tell the other lawyer George employs that Ken knows where the diamonds are. Archie meets up with Wanda, and they decide to pay Ken a visit. At this point, Archie knows that Wanda was one of the Diamond Thieves and has been lying this whole time. But when Archie admits that he fell in love with her, she seems genuinely hurt that he dumped her. But that doesn't last long. Archie seems to be on board with taking some of the loot and heading off into the sunset with Wanda now that they know where the diamonds are and Wanda has the key to the safety deposit box. When Archie runs in to find Ken at the flat, Otto runs into the car and drives off with Wanda. A bit of Monty Python reunion happens when Ken stutters to Archie that they're headed to the airport, and that takes way too long. Wanda knocks out Otto at the airport, which only delays him for a little bit. Otto then finds Stephen Fry wandering around, and he knocks him out for his boarding pass. Archie catches up to Otto and threatens him with the gun that Otto got through security, but Otto does not take Archie seriously. Otto tricks Archie by challenging him to a fistfight, which Otto uses to take back the gun once Archie puts it down. He then directs Archie outside on the tarmac and forces him to get into a barrel. But little does Otto know that Ken is out for revenge, driving a steamroller. Archie buys time by insulting America, which Otto falls for. Still, the steamroller is slow enough that when Otto finally notices it, he doesn't take Ken seriously either. However, he's wandered into some wet cement and is now stuck, which means it doesn't matter how slow the steamroller is. When Ken gets his revenge, he even loses his stutter. Archie manages to catch up to the plane and to Wanda as they fly off. By the way, this is a lot of pre-9/11 shenanigans going on in this airport
scene. I have notes about that.
As they fly off, we see Otto somehow on the side of the plane covered in cement instead of just dead. He ends up falling off the plane. We are then told via text on the screen that Archie and Wanda got married, had 17 children, and founded a leper colony. Ken became master of ceremonies at the London Sea World, and Otto immigrated to South Africa and became Minister for Justice, which I guess is a knock on the justice system that was imprisoning Nelson Mandela. I don't know. Anyway, that's how the movie ends. Guys, what did you think of A Fish Called Wanda?
Aaron?
This movie's hilarious. I love it. It's always a fun watch. My notes are pretty much just points of the movie that I laughed out loud. I will start, however, with Kevin Klein, who this time I was much more aware of how athletic this performance
is
that he's doing. from the like little pull-up launch onto the bed where he lands, you know, in perfect cross-legged on the bed, after he says "I am disappointed" and kicks the car, like that little leap he does to kick the car is like really athletic, impressive. Even though you'd never get away with this, the way he gets the gun through the metal detector, just kind of swaps it out around the side and catches it after he walks through, like that's not easy stuff. I don't know, I was just impressed with a lot of the athletic stuff he does in this movie. And I guess that's a good point to, I mean, maybe go into a little Oscar talk. It blows my mind that he won an Oscar for this. Mm-hmm. Like in hindsight, it's one of those things that you look at and go, that was possible just to do a hilarious comedic role and just win an Oscar. It's the only time he's ever been nominated. Mm-hmm. It's just a weird, and I think the screenplay was nominated as well. And maybe the only time Cleese was nominated, I don't know, but it's just one of those in hindsight where I look back at those Oscars and go, good for you. Mm-hmm. Like, I wish we could do this more. And there's even been some chatter and somebody had an interview where they said Oscars used to award, you know, awards to, you know, big budget, you know, fan friendly movies. And now since he blamed it on whoever it was talking, I forget who it was, blamed it on Weinstein. You know, ever since, you know, the Shakespeare in Love thing happened, it's just been, you know, a whole different animal to win awards. And I don't think that's completely wrong. I think it's a little reductive, but I don't think it's completely wrong, especially when you look back at a movie like this, you know,
well,
having
Oscar
contention.
Well, it was the Russo brothers that said it.
That's who it was. Yes.
So I think that adds
negates
context.
It a little bit. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure it does. I'm glad you remembered that. This movie is probably single-handedly responsible for doesthedogdie.com. Mm-hmm. At least I'm going to start that rumor right here and right now. But I love that subplot. It's that idea that this man loves animals so much, but he's trying to kill a human being and then accidentally keeps killing her animals is just gold. It's just, it's unique. It's beautiful. It's hilarious. And just the pain on his face. Palin is so good in this movie. I love his comedy chops. In fact, there's one, I think my favorite moment of his is during the scene that you said went on too long, which I kind of disagree. I actually love that scene between him and Cleese where he's trying to get the hotel name out of him. And the reason all of that works for me is the look on Palin's face after Cleese says the hotel, and then Palin just says it right after him. Like the full thing without a stutter. And he kind of goes, like, did I just do that after I took 5 minutes not being able to? It's just a beautiful comedic look. So I really enjoyed that. Jamie Lee Curtis's scenes from this movie could be used as a Duolingo ad. Her performance when people are speaking other languages was so ridiculously and unnecessarily hot. And that might just be to the fact that Jamie Lee Curtis is ridiculously hot. But yeah, that was amazing. And then you mentioned Stephen Fry showing up for a hot second. And then the only other bit that I wanted to mention that I caught this time that made me laugh more than previous times was John Cleese when she drops the bomb of him leaving at 5 till 7 or whatever. And he goes, Wanda, I wonder. Like, it's just perfect, perfect delivery. And he is so good at that. Man, I love this movie. I just laughed so much during this movie. So it was good to watch it again for sure. Yeah.
This is, I think, only my second time seeing it. And it's been 15 years. So it played brand new to me. And I think Palin steals the movie, and I'll come back to that later because I have a couple points I want to make. But you're right, Aaron, and I'm glad you said everything you said. You stole all my thunder, but I'm glad you said it about him killing the dogs. And even though he loves animals, it's one of the best like comedic subplots I think in any movie I've seen. And almost all of his performance is with his face. Even when he's stuttering, the comedy is coming from his face, his expressions, as much as anything else. Obviously, I think Kevin Kline is great, deserving of all the accolades he got. His character's such a freaking scumbag, and I love how much he throws himself into it. you know, everybody's great. I'm not trying to take away from anybody. You mentioned the sex scene, and apparently he made Jamie Lee Curtis laugh so hard when they were filming that she had to cover her face with a pillow. I thought that was hilarious because that makes total sense to me. I wanted to point out a couple of lines that struck me as exceptionally funny or well delivered. There's that rant where Kevin Kline cusses out John Cleese for like 30 seconds. fuck you. And then Cleese just goes, "You are a true Vulgarian, aren't you?" And I just thought that was a great reaction.
You're the Vulgarian, you fuck.
I love when Otto and Wanda are arguing and he says, "Apes don't read philosophy." And she says, "Yes, they do, Otto. They just can't understand it." And it makes no sense. And I love that there's a lot of that kind of humor in this movie. Like the fact that the movie's called A Fish Called Wanda. And the fish called Wanda really only has one key moment of being involved. Yeah, the airport has no security. And I don't even think it has regular other passengers paying attention to anything because there's a lot of shenanigans happening there. I made a note. Do we feel like Deadpool's Zamboni goof is inspired by the Michael Palin steamroller bit in this movie? Because that was all I could think of when that's because it's taking so long to get there. That's the comedy. That's such a slow moving vehicle.
Well, and there was a similar one in Austin Powers as well. The slow moving, pavement equipment or whatever going after somebody and whatever.
You're right.
It could be. It could be. I don't know if that was one of the first ones to do that kind of thing, but.
Roger Rabbit did a steamroller
same year.
Gag the same year. So, yeah, it was something in the zeitgeist.
I wonder if they're all inspired by this movie. It wouldn't surprise me. So IMDb says that Michael Palin's father in real life had a stutter and that he infused a lot of his experience in playing Ken with what he knew about real life stuttering, meaning it's less pronounced when he's around people he trusts and it's more pronounced when he's around people he doesn't. And I think that's fascinating I'm still not completely comfortable with a stutter being the central focus of the comedy for a full 3 or 4 minutes. And it feels to me like one of those things where Palin wasn't offended by any of it because he grew up with somebody who had a stutter and is probably thought his father wouldn't be offended by it, or maybe his father just told him he wasn't. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure that goes for all people who stutter. So that I was too uncomfortable to laugh very much at that particular scene, just because it, the whole scene, like the script probably says he stutters for 5 minutes. But again, I wasn't involved in the making of this movie. I'm not going to pinpoint anybody's intentions. I felt like in this day and age, I'm not sure that would play all that well, which I say while complimenting his performance.
It's interesting because I also had a little bit of cringe during that stuff. And for me, it's difficult. Maybe you feel the same way, because when you're not a member of a group or somebody who yes. you know, might be involved directly with knowing what it's like to have a stutter or that kind of thing, you kind of have to step back and have your own feelings. That's fine. But go, okay, you know, I should check in with, you know, people who do in my life or whatever and see kind of how they feel about it. And the recent, like you did a little bit of research too, and it seemed like speech impediment groups lauded this movie for its portrayal, if I'm reading a lot of the stuff of the day correctly. Now, 30 or 40 years later, or whatever, almost 40 years later, maybe that's different, and maybe there's some, you know, other things, but yeah, whenever something is the butt of the joke, that always strikes me as a little bit cringe. But, you know, I don't know how you do it.
I had read opposite of that. Now, I imagine, because there's no group is a monolith, right? So, like,
exactly. And that's the other thing. Yeah, for sure.
You're going to hear stories where there was a group that said this was fine, and then there's going to another group that says that was fucked up. And so, you know, which one to decide? Which one is it? Is it really? I mean, you know, it is tough to know. I was having a little bit of a hard time laughing at it. I think in 1988 it plays a lot better, obviously, because you know you're not thinking about that type of thing. But, I remember. I don't know if it was around the time. It might have been just when I first watched this movie in the mid 90s, but. I feel like a lot of people were more upset at Kevin Kline's character making fun of him more than anything about that. But that's his character to me. I don't even consider that all that bad as for the movie to do that with a character. But I think a lot of times people were like, he won the Oscar for being a guy who was, you know, just making fun of stuttering people the whole time. And it's like, it's not entirely that, you know, it's not, you know, but I mean, he is an asshole and almost every single thing that he does in this. Anyway, I guess you just have to make a decision on your own and say either that's for me or not. So,
and I think it's a worthy conversation, and it's not gone away either. I mean, we just had something very similar with Licorice Pizza a few years ago with the racist waiter, where it's like the joke is supposed to be what an idiot jerk this is for, you know, speaking in the voice that he does. But the crowds, is that what they're laughing at? Or if you're, you know, like I remember, I can't remember if it was Bo and Yang, but it was somebody who, you know, was popular, was saying something about being in a crowd and just going, I don't think you're laughing at the right thing. Like, you know, you're laughing at the performance, which is making that person the butt of the joke, as opposed to, you know, that person being a jerk. Mm-hmm. So we still deal with trying to figure out you know, that kind of humor, and you know, maybe we should step away from it. Maybe it's just, you know, if you're gonna hurt people, then just
funny
don't do
people
it.
Are always gonna say, if we're not making you uncomfortable, we're not doing comedy. But I'm
sure.
Not sure. I'm sorry. Okay, I have two more. I have a question and then one more thing I want to point out. Do we think Wanda actually falls for Archie? And if so, at what point in the movie does that happen? Or is she just escaping with him because he's the... But they go on to have 17 kids. I kept trying to find the moment in the movie where she goes from trying to use him to actually falling for him, and I don't know if I can...
I think the tipping point is when he starts speaking Russian and she's ready to... She's actually ready to actually be in a relationship with him there. Now, she says, are you rich? And he says, no, it's my wife that's rich, so I don't have any money. And she kind of like backs off at that point. So, hey, you seem to be the complete package with intelligence and you can speak other languages, which is my sexual trigger for whatever reason in this movie. But that caused her to back off. Of course, then the family walks in while he's stripping down and he has second thoughts about the whole relationship and everything. And that's when he dumps her or whatever. But I think that's the area where we're supposed to believe she's actually really likes him.
Okay.
I thought there was a car scene. I can't remember if it's before or after that, but there's a scene in a car where he's driving and she turns and looks at him and says something and he is very witty back to her, like intelligent or something he says. Mm-hmm. And the smile on her face to me was the first real moment in that performance where I thought the character was actually looking lovingly at somebody and not just manipulating somebody.
And I think it kind of builds, you know, it builds over time. Like, I think that may be a surprise to her and that she's smiling because, whoa, maybe he's more than just a mark, you know, that type of thing. So yeah, I think there are probably a lot of little scenes that you can see where she's like, I kind of actually like this guy, but I really believe that tipping point where that she's gone over the line on it or over the edge or wherever that that weird mystical portal from I Like to Love or whatever is in that scene where he's speaking the Russian and everything. But yeah, I think there's little things that build that up.
All right. Yeah. Well, sorry for this one last thing, but this IMDb trivia note was too insane not to read to the masses. In 1989, when this movie was shown in theaters in Denmark, a Danish man named Ole Benson literally laughed himself to death during the scene where Ken gets the chips up his nose. His heart rate went up to 500 beats per minute, and he succumbed to cardiac arrest. The reason is that he had made a joke a few years earlier with his family during dinner where he put cauliflower up everybody's nose. And the contest was to see who could eat their carrots without the cauliflower falling out. And he remembered that during the scene and died.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's insane.
Your tie is the same as mine, only the pattern is inverted. I read that too. The apparently, like, his son confirmed it or whatever, but it still sounds very urban legendy to me, even with the son confirming it and everything.
Yeah, I don't care. I had to share that with the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Danish people seem amazing.
Yeah.
We need to put it that way.
Pretty much. All right, let's go on to our super secret double feature.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.
Shh. Be very, very quiet.
Secret. What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
All right. Jeremy, kick us off with the super secret double feature.
I'm terrified to go first.
Okay. Aaron, do the super secret.
All right.
Go ahead. Okay. Oh, Jeremy's going to do it. Okay.
I'm going with Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. It's a little on the nose. Aaron already had it pulled up because that's his as well.
Yep.
I don't believe it. I've got three others. I'm going to change. You go first and talk about Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
I mean, it's perfect. Like, when I watch this movie, I'm just like, oh, like tonally, These movies are so similar, even though they're a little bit different plot wise, but just like, you know, the caricatures and the people playing different parts and, you know, everybody's deceiving everybody else. And no, it is in my mind, the perfect answer. It is not a surprise that you would steal that from
me. I may never go first again. I'm telling you, this is mentally scarring.
I love that I gave it away by putting the image on the screen.
I mean, you wouldn't have that ready. For any other reason. So I did also write down, because of all the double crosses that happen in this movie, I did write down Reindeer Games. It's not as much of a comedy, but there are a bunch of people playing different roles to different characters, and everybody keeps that movie has more double crosses than maybe any other movie that exists. But yeah, Dirty Old Games.
Well, I was just about to bring up the movie Heist, who also has the late Gene Hackman in it. David Mamet Heist movie has a million. Like, it's one of those. That movie and Wild Things have more double crosses in it per square inch than any movie that you've ever seen. Like, every time you think this person is that, this is their role in this movie, they have some secret thing that they've been, you know, fostering this whole time. But anyway, I thought of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels quite a bit watching this too. It's that late 80s vibe to it.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is that comedy vibe. If you had taken Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, I would have gone with like Some Like It Hot or something like that, which it's much earlier, but has that same kind of, you know, everybody deceiving each other, you know, trying to steal something kind of vibe. So. Yeah. So, yeah.
Now we need to talk about what is next week's homework, and I believe it is Jeremy's pick. So, Jeremy, pick the movie that we will be watching for next week.
It's my turn to make people spend money. Wait, that came out wrong. This week, we're going to go with one of my favorite movies. And it's 1999's Three Kings. Occasionally controversial director David O. Russell.
Mm-hmm.
Starring George Clooney, Marky Mark, and Ice Cube. That's two rappers. And one television.
Yep.
This is a movie about three American soldiers in Iraq who find an Iraqi ass map that leads to some gold. And en route to stealing said gold, they encounter some people being mistreated and have to decide whether or not they're going to help them. And I haven't seen this in probably 7 or 8 years. Very excited to watch it again. And it is only available to rent for $3.99 on various platforms. And I apologize in advance. But I've been sitting on this one for a year, and it's just not going to stream. Sorry.
It's funny. I actually had this on my radar as a possible big recommend as well, and I had kind of avoided it for maybe the same reasons, although I had picked a lot of other stuff that was just streaming. But this was a movie for sure that I want to revisit because it's great. But, yeah. Over the years, it's maybe possibly more known for George Clooney strangling David O. Russell on set than the movie itself. Even the movie is really good. So anyway, all right, Three Kings it is. That'll be awesome. We will do that next week. All right, looks like we have time to do some questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
Question. What are some bad match double features? Movies that might be paired together for some stretch of a reason, but shouldn't. And their example is 9 to 5 and 28 Weeks Later. And I'm assuming because there are numbers in the title. I'll go ahead. I'll say my reason is movies that have the same title. So I decided to pair Brian De Palma's Sisters with Tina Fey, Amy Poehler comedy Sisters.
It's a perfect double feature.
It would be awful. And then I could also see David Cronenberg's Crash not going very well with Paul Haggis's Crash.
We could do a whole show of this. We could do Heat and The Heat.
Yes. Yep.
That slides into mine nicely. So mine is also a title pun, if you will. I want to do a double feature of 2008's Milk. with 1994's Milk Money.
Yeah, that's not a good double feature at all. That's what I call sour milk, Aaron.
That's right.
I went with 21 Bridges and Bridges Over Madison County.
You're right, though. We could do a million of these. It's a really good question.
Great question.
Another question here. What is a realistic movie character you wish you could be? The example here is I'm going with Peter Gibbons from Office Space. I'll go ahead. I want to be Liev Schreiber in Spotlight. I like the idea of being not only a smart guy, but also the person who can be cool in any situation and persuasive. That is the character I strive to be.
I like it.
I'm going with Tom Hartman, played by David Strathairn, from The River Wild, the husband from The River Wild, very dedicated and normy husband who does his part when the time comes. That's, you know, if I can just be that, I'll be happy. So,
you know how they tell you when you're growing up that if you want to attract the people you want to be attracted to you, you should have confidence, right? So I'm going with Lloyd Dobler from Say Anything, because this is a nerdy ass outsider and he has zero worry about talking to the hottest girl in school. And he's always been my hero for that reason, because I was definitely the nerdy outsider, but I didn't have that confidence around women. And I think that's why she's initially attracted to him. Anyway.
Yep. Going to the chat on the double feature question, Shaggy says Dawn of the Dead and Dead Again. Yeah, that would be a bad one. Tatsu says Nine. I'm assuming one of those nines is the Rob Marshall one that had Daniel Day-Lewis in it, and then there was the other nine, and maybe the Elijah Wood nine, number nine.
That would
be ridiculous for sure. There's a lot of movies with the number nine in it you could throw into this double feature that would be bad. Flyboy says, real double feature from my childhood, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea and St. Francis of Assisi? Okay. I'm going to have to trust you on that one.
Is that supposed to be a CC? Is that the pun? Is the C bottom of the C?
Yeah, I think so. On to the who you want to be, a realistic character you want to be. Michael says Indiana Jones is one of those realistic characters he wants to be. Flyboy asked me if I'd want to be Liev Schreiber in Spotlight or the real Marty Baron. I don't know if the real Marty Baron is like Liev Schreiber or not, but I like the way Liev Schreiber plays it, so that's who I want to be.
Always the movie version.
That's right.
Always the movie version. You never want to be the real
person.
Exactly.
The real people are terrible and overrated.
That's right.
Josh says, I want to be Sam Neill. That is all. Tatsu says, Tim Oliphant in The Perfect Getaway. Outstanding. Yeah, okay. That's another one, by the way, I want to recommend someday is Perfect Getaway. Yeah.
And it's not streaming.
Pauly says the dude from The Big Lebowski, not a care in the world at the end. And Castro says Denzel Washington and The Great Debaters. And if you want to be Denzel Washington at any point in time, you're doing good for yourself, I think. All right, that's going to do it for this week. Once again, the movie for next week is Three Kings, and that'll do it for today. Once again, chat, thank you for coming out. Appreciate you coming out and watching us today. And that's going to do it for today. We'll see you next time. See ya. Bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Rawhide, keep them doggies rolling.
Somebody has been using my microphone since I was last in here.
Those bastards.
There's been a lot of teeth talk in the world because of White Lotus has the woman from Sex Education.
Amy Lou Wood.
Yes, yes. And she has these prominent front two teeth. And I love any time there's physical representation that's different than, you know, whatever the norm is, and somebody's like totally comfortable with it. Like, you know, she'll just talk about, this is who I am, this is how I look. And I just think, you know, we need more of that. More people just going, look, they're all just bodies and they're all different in some way or another. And, you know, it's okay. Instead of everybody having to have veneers, you know?
I think it's the first episode where Chloe comes to the bar and they meet her character. And like one of the first things she says is, I love your teeth.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, wow, I hope that actress is okay with that dialogue. And then I read an interview and she's completely okay with it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Loves her teeth. I just watched the Happy Gilmore 2 teaser.
Yeah.
There's a Happy Gilmore 2, huh?
How is that?
That's, I didn't realize that would be news to you. Yes, it hits Netflix in June, Chris. Yeah, the teaser makes it look exactly like what I feared it would be, which is 55-year-old Adam Sandler.
Yeah.
In the clothes of a 25-year-old Adam Sandler character. Like,
Yeah.
It didn't feel like the Happy Gilmore character at all. It felt like Adam Sandler.
Is there a Drew Carey fight instead of a Bob Barker fight?
I'm sure there's something like that.
Bob Barker probably lent his likeness to the movie or whatever. Like, he did that thing. You can just go and AI him in the movie.
There you go.
That's possible. They are all, like, a lot of modern golfers. And apparently cameo in this thing. I saw Justin Thomas and Bryson DeChambeau and Rory. And anyway, it just, he's just so calm and old. Like, the part of the whole fun of that character was that he was out of control and wild. And I guess maybe, I mean, you know, I can't remember the last Adam Sandler movie I watched that I was like, that was good. But I guess
that's the thing. Like, he's never been like a critical darling in his comedies or anything like that. I think I've always been a huge fan of those early ones. The Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, even though it wasn't as insane. What's the Wedding Singer, I think is fun.
Yeah.
And then I think once he started getting the $20 million paychecks, it started going downhill. And Waterboy, he's still kind of, it got that young Adam Sandler, anything goes kind of craziness. And I'm a fan of the Waterboy, but it also can be pretty annoying. But after that, it was like Little Nicky, and he started growing up, and all these movies started growing up with him, and he wasn't as insane or zany anymore. So that's where I started losing interest in Adam Sandler movies. Those Grown Ups movies and, you know, all those. He's just kind of lost that edge or whatever you want to call it. I don't know if those were edgy comedies. They were just, he was just not afraid to do anything in those things.
Not a Jack and Jill fan?
I'm waiting for the Jack and Jill was good actually article to pop up
yes,
somewhere.
That'd be amazing. He shows up in dramas and does fine, you know, like Uncut Gems or Hustle. He was great in Hustle. Did you guys see Hustle?
That's the thing, right? Like, he's,
that's what I mean. I mentioned that in comedies. That's what I was talking about.
Yeah, like, he's not funny anymore.
Totally. Like, Punch Drunk Love is a critical darling, and Uncut Gems is. I don't know if I saw Hustle, but also Spanglish. I think he got some sort of you know. I mean, that movie's not good, but what was the other one? Oh, it was Rain or Me. Rain or Me was another one that he got some acclaim for.
The last comedy that I really enjoyed him in was You Are So Not Invited to My Bat Mitzvah, which is actually really sweet and cute. And I think it works because it's not focused on like his extended adolescence type humor. It's more focused on the family aspect and the kids and the daughter. And that was a family thing for him. Like, that's his family.
Yeah,
that movie. So, but it's pretty good. It wasn't bad.
Yeah,
I think it's awesome that rich and famous people can put their kids in movies and make their kids rich and famous. I think that rules.
Yep. You know, there's no doubt that some of these kids are working hard, but they think that working hard is what got them in through the door. I think that's the problem,
right.
the disconnect a lot of times these, you know, Nepo kids have is.
I'm not going to say, I don't know how hard she's working, but I do feel like the entire movie Trap was designed to make his daughter.
Oh, for sure.
More of a pop star than she was before.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that.
Yeah. No,
I don't think he's even. Yeah, I was about to say, I don't think he's even been shy about saying that.
Is there a dog behind you?
There is. Yes.
I see an occasional tail and yes. I think I hear some noises.
Yeah, this is Marley. I'm not sure who wants to name their dog Marley.
No kidding. But holy shit.
This is Marley, and she's staying with us for a few days, and she just got a little bit anxious for some reason. Not sure why. So she's, I don't know if you can you hear her whining?
I could, but before I knew it was a dog, I thought it was
me?
Voices in
you
your
thought
house.
I was whining?
I thought it was the voices in my head. Personally,
somebody two rooms over talking or something.
I like Adam Sandler.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.